Your North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our blind and print-impaired listening audience. It's the Independent, the Indie Week magazine. I'm John Federson to read you this week's issue, dated May the 29th of 2025. All right, our broadcast today is less concerned, actually, with the hard news. There are a few articles, more backgrounds and feature articles, which are pleasant to read after all the budgetary things and school clashes and articles of that nature. But there are a few, and the first concerns recordings which show a North Carolina trooper and a supervisor lied to Raleigh police about a Tyrone Mason crash. Recordings released last week by the North Carolina Highway Patrol and Raleigh Police Department show State Trooper Garrett Macario pursuing 31-year-old Tyrone Mason along Capitol Boulevard in the early morning hours of October 7, 2024. But upon discovering Mason's vehicle wrecked, Macario did not attempt to render aid to Mason. Instead, he called his supervisor, Matthew Morrison, and in a recording of their conversation, the two decided that Macario would tell responding police officers that he was not chasing Mason's vehicle and had only happened upon the crash. The recordings were released Friday following a successful court petition brought by a coalition of media outlets, including the Indy and the Assembly. Mason's family had also pushed for their public release. The recordings include Macario's body and dash camera footage, as well as body cam footage from responding Raleigh officers. Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman said in a report released on Wednesday she would not file criminal charges against either Macario or Morrison related to the crash. She had announced in January that she was dismissing more than 200 cases involving the two after the State Bureau of Investigation, that's SBI, prompted her to review recordings from the crash, which was under investigation. Also Wednesday, Henrietta Mason, Tyrone Mason's mother, filed a federal lawsuit against Macario for failing to render aid and violating Mason's constitutional rights to due process. The recordings show Macario stationed outside a Speedway gas station on Capitol Boulevard just north of downtown Raleigh. A vehicle approaches from behind, traveling north, and Macario turns on his sirens and begins a chase that lasts just over a minute. He then switches off the sirens, drives past the crash, turns around, and returns to the wreck site. His body camera records him calling for Raleigh police and emergency medical services. He gets out of his red, unmarked car and surveys the scene with a flashlight. He approaches Mason's smashed-up black Chevrolet Malibu and inspects damage, but does not look inside or ask if the driver needs help. He then walks away from the car, checks out the crashed debris, picks up a tire and removes it from the road, and then calls Morrison. He can be heard telling Morrison he clocked a car coming out of downtown, quote, at like 70 miles in a 40. And I went to stop him. He took off. And I just went ahead and disengaged because the driving behavior is coming outbound. And when I came around the corner, I'd already turned my stuff off. He wrecked. Please tell me you're fucking joking, Morrison says. No, Massaria responds. He then reiterates he turned his lights and sirens off and drove up to Mason's vehicle. Mason asked if Macario had radioed in the chase. No, sir. The second I realized it was not a smart chase, I literally turned all my stuff off. I had lost sight, and when I came around the corner, I saw the smoke. Morrison can be heard saying, sounds to me like that's RPD's problem. Macario says RPD's on the way and acknowledges he is the first law enforcement officer on scene. and saying, I mean, I'm not being like weird about it. I just didn't feel it was a safe chase. Morrison asks if Macario's camera is still rolling. Macario says it is, but on a different recording since he had already disengaged. He reiterates what happened. Morrison reiterates what happened as Macario described it and again says it's RPD's problem, saying, I wouldn't mention anything to them about you trying to stop him. No, I won't, agrees Macario. Just say, hey man, I drove up on this and leave it at that, says Morrison. Macario confirms EMS is on the way, and Morrison asks if Macario has, quote, confirmed that Mason is DRT, though, thought to mean dead right there, according to the Mason's lawsuit. Yeah, says Macario. Okie dokie. Yeah, that's RPD's problem, says Morrison. I wouldn't say shit to them. They end the call. Later, Macario's body cam footage shows him approaching two RPD officers as they walk up to the crash. Yeah, it's a fatal, he tells them. I rolled up on it. He obviously came over the median. The officers ask Macario if he had checked on the driver. Not yet, no. Once police and EMS are on the scene and responding, body-worn camera footage shows an RPD officer approaching Macario, who's standing a few feet away. Were you, like, trying to pull him over or something? The police officer asks. No, Macario responds. This is just the little area I work, so when I came up on it, I saw all the smoke, heard all the cars hitting the debris. I moved a tire out of the road. I guess everything else on the scene is still intact. In her report, Freeman wrote that Mason had accelerated to about 100 miles an hour in response to troopers' attempt to stop him. Mason lost control of the vehicle, the report states, causing his death from multiple blunt force injuries, including a fracture to his cervical spine. According to the State Office of Chief Medical Examiner, Mason had a blood alcohol level of 0.11 at the time of the crash. The report states that dash cam video captured with Macario speaking with another RPD officer within 10 minutes of Macario's initial statements, denying that he chased Mason. No recordings of the conversation exist, but the police officer told SBI investigators Macario acknowledged, quote, that he had attempted to stop Mr. Mason from speeding prior to the wreck. A Raleigh police captain also told investigators Macario acknowledged that he had tried to stop Mason for speeding. Freeman's report states, Trooper Macario's efforts to stop Mr. Mason don't give rise to any criminal violation. While his initial false statements to the officers who arrived on scene to investigate are inexcusable, his subsequent truthful statements within the relevant time frame prevent the state from being able to move forward with a successful prosecution. Freeman concludes the evidence suggests Macario and Morrison were initially untruthful, quote, to keep them from having to manage the crash scene and do reconstruction investigation. The comments about the crash being RPD's problem allude to this, states the report, rather than an intentional obstruction of justice. The report notes the State Highway Patrol has the authority to decide whether Macario and Morrison will continue to be employed, and that Wake County will not prosecute cases that rely on their testimony. Finally, the report criticizes Raleigh PD's handling of the investigation of the circumstances of the wreck. Henrietta Mason, Tyrone's mother, had attempted to get information related to the circumstances of her son's death for months, the report acknowledges. Mrs. Mason may have had her questions answered earlier had a more thorough job of investigating the circumstances of the wreck been done, states the report. Last week, his mother filed a federal lawsuit against Macario. Her attorneys, including Raleigh lawyer Sean Cecil and the prominent civil rights attorney Bakari Sellers, argue Macario conspired with Morrison to cover up the wreck. Macario violated Mason's due process rights to life and bodily autonomy under the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment. Henrietta Mason seeks a jury trial and damages for personal loss, as well as medical and funeral expenses, in an amount to be determined by the court. The complaint states, quote, Defendant Macario knew or should have known, and every reasonable officer in his position would have concluded that the failure to render aid to decedent Mason was cruel and unlawful. Defendant Macario's clear failure to render aid was the cause in fact and the proximate cause of decedent Mason's injuries and death. All right, and we'll just move ahead to many of the background, more interesting articles that aren't urgently connected with political events, let's say. This one from Lena Geller, and it's titled, it's about the end of the school year. I've been recently seeing some YouTube's tips and tricks about universities, particularly closing up for the year. What happens to all the stuff? She writes, I salvaged $6,000 of luxury items discarded by Duke students. Why did it make me feel so terrible? She goes on, I live in an apartment building in downtown Durham that houses more Duke University undergrads than any other category of person. A friend once characterized it as an adult dorm, so it wasn't all that surprising when last week I found a cute little table in the trash room on my floor. At the end of the school year, a lot gets thrown away. The table was in great condition amid stacks of linens and unopened boxes of date nut energy bites made from clear acrylic. Its edges were tinged a neon lemon-lime color that changed with the light, sometimes appearing to be part of the acrylic itself, other times a reflection dancing along its curves. I took it home. When I looked it up online, I discovered that it cost $900, shipping cost $200. That was retrieved from the trash room at the end of my hall where you put things down the chute. The real gold mine is the ground floor room the chute empties into, accessible by one of the elevators. This is where, around graduation each year, you can find dozens of vacuums, Keurigs, stainless steel trash cans in every size and shape imaginable, mattresses, mirrors, and enough luxury goods to make a reseller weep with joy. The first time I went down there last week, I noticed something neon in a tote bag and pulled out $400 Balenciaga slides. Nearby were $980 Valentino sneakers, worn but definitely wearable. More than $1,000 of Lululemon workout clothing tumbled from a bag onto a couch. You don't really have to do any digging. Most of the stuff I've gotten was sitting on top of discarded furniture, but you do have to rush. After I took the Lululemon haul upstairs, I returned to find city waste workers loading things into a garbage truck off to a landfill. The volume of discarded clothing seems consistent with generational trends. Textile waste in the United States went up by more than 50% between 2000 and 2018. Not every treasure is a flashy brand name item. I also recovered pink satin pajamas that I remember seeing on someone attending a pajama party on my floor, and a ruffled olive green Top Gun romper from a Halloween event. Parentheses. Sadly, there was nothing from the risque Dr. Seuss party. A few months ago, a fire alarm went off. It became apparent just how much of the building is occupied by Duke students, as nearly everyone except me, my roommate, and a family with two young kids was drunk and dressed in Cat in the Hat costumes. It feels wrong for this much stuff to have been thrown out in the first place, but it also feels mildly wrong to take it. So it was nice to get intermittent reassurance from my building's maintenance man, Eric. The first time, as I was scurrying back to my room, carrying an upholstered kitchen chair that my cats now spend all their time in, I passed Eric in the hallway. He asked me how I was. Just doing some scavenging, I said. I must have looked guilty because he said, that's okay. A few days later, I was again downstairs in the trash room when Eric walked in. I moved to leave, feeling awkward about being caught again. You're welcome in here any time, he assured. The sheer volume of valuable, usable things being discarded boggles the brain. particularly when it comes to items like clothing with the tags still on and unopened, unexpired food items. Trying to make sense of things, I made spreadsheets. The first tracks the prices and brands of the items I kept, donated, or sold. And this is a spreadsheet of about 20 items, luggage, chairs, air filters, slippers, clothing, etc. The total value of that spreadsheet came to around $6,000, not including several items I couldn't find prices for. The second spreadsheet compares Duke's donation collection with that of other universities in an effort to understand whether this college town phenomenon is universal. I gathered publicly available data from university websites and press releases, supplemented by direct inquiries. Duke told me their Devil's Care donation initiative connected £32,000 this year through partnerships with TROSA and Goodwill. Pardon me. Ali Harrison, Senior Associate Dean for Residence Life, says the university places donation bins in every hall on campus, plus off-campus Duke housing like Blue Light and Swift Apartments. He also notes that Duke students who live off-campus can schedule a TROSA pickup for large or bulky items and large donations. I emailed six universities asking about their donation programs and collection data. Most didn't respond or declined. One directed me to a public webpage, Rice University, that's down in Houston area, I think, whose Give a Hoot, Donate Your Loot campaign recently won a statewide award in Texas, sent a detailed response. They reported that they collected around 11,000 pounds of durable goods from students this year. They have around 9,000 total students, with roughly half undergrads. Rice's approach is to implement collections every semester, not just during the spring move-out. By maintaining a constant, consistent presence through the academic year, wrote a spokesperson, the campaign has become a familiar part of the student experience, helping them, students, plan ahead to donate rather than discard. Looking at the data, Duke's donation rate, about £5 per undergraduate, is comparable to that at other wealthy private universities like Princeton, 7.6, and Georgetown, 6.1. Duke actually outperforms some schools with similar student demographics, like the University of Chicago, 0.8 pounds, and Northwestern, 0.9 pounds. Most large public universities hover around £1 per student. The emotional reality of my salvaging week was harder to organize into neat columns. For one, I started feeling like everything I own is crappy. When you're pulling something out of the trash, it doesn't feel like it's going to be a luxury item. So at first, I didn't think much of a comforter. I salvaged and offered to my boyfriend, who's always looking for blankets for his dog to lie on. After looking up the cost, $220, and thread count, 600, I went back on that offer and replaced my existing comforter with the salvaged one. The next day, my boyfriend found his own down comforter in the trash. Most items I salvaged were like new, but some needed attention. It felt good to wash, clean, and mend things, removing stains from a blouse, fixing belt loops on black slacks, but then futility would set in. I tried to get the stains out of a pair of muddy Nike high tops with floral embroidery using a Solo cup I salvaged as a mixing receptacle to stir together baking soda and hydrogen peroxide into a thick paste, but even after slathering it onto the shoes, the stains persist. I also spent some time scrubbing a toaster oven, only to go back to the trash room a few days later and find one that's cleaner and fancier. Retail value, $400. In what would become my final scavenging trip of the year, I tried carrying too many things at once. A handheld vacuum, an air filter, some velvet hangers, and dropped the toaster oven, which splashed water all over me from its steam reservoir. Sometimes it's a spill that does it. I stood there damp, surrounded by other people's discards, feeling ridiculous. My apartment was already filled with rescued items. I went home, found the air filter didn't fit my unit, and cried. The next night, my cat jumped down from the salvaged chair he loves, used his litter box, and then kicked litter everywhere, as per usual. Managing litter has been an ongoing struggle. Various vacuums have proved too weak or bulky to reach the corners behind the box, so I usually just sweep with a handheld broom and dustpan. But as I bent over with my dustpan that night, I remembered the vacuum I'd salvaged just before dropping the toaster oven. I found it with its charging cord sitting right next to it, still coiled neatly with a twist tie. I grabbed it from my pile of findings and turned it on. It was the most powerful little vacuum I've ever seen. Its pointed nose, perfect for crevices. Now, an article from May the 16th that I have put aside until there's time. And now, today, there's time. It's about Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker. And this article is titled Everything Matters, by Lena Gittler. Ken Burns has produced nearly all of his documentaries with PBS, over 30 films and series spanning four decades, and his upcoming series on the Revolutionary War is no different. This six-part, 12-hour The American Revolution, which Burns directed alongside Sarah Botstein and David Schmidt, aims to present our country's founding struggle as more complex and less sanitized than traditional historical accounts, weaving together perspectives of not just founding fathers and British generals, but women, everyday militiamen, Native Americans, enslaved people, and citizens caught in the crossfire. What's different this time, however, is the existential threat facing the platform that has hosted Burns' work since his 1981 debut, Brooklyn Bridge. The publicity cycle for Burns' latest work, which premieres in November to coincide with the 250th anniversary of the beginning of the Revolutionary War, falls just after President Trump signed an executive order instructing the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to stop funding for PBS, which Trump calls biased and woke propaganda. It's the latest in a decades-long battle over public broadcasting, but one that the CEO of PBS, Paula Kerger, recently called an all-out effort to take us out. It's hard to miss the irony. A documentary about the birth of American democracy, launching on a network fighting for its own survival in a deeply divided nation. Burns was in Raleigh this week, that's to say May the 15th, for a preview screening at the Martin Marietta Center for the Performing Arts and to tape an interview with PBS North Carolina. Afterwards, I had 10 minutes with the 17-time Emmy winner, and he almost immediately brought up the importance of local public media stations in preserving America's stories from the bottom up. So this is a Q&A type article written up that way. Burns, excuse me for a second. I have a daughter that needs a little bit of attention. He types out a text. She just got home from school. How old is she? 14, my youngest. I have four daughters. You know that you're the dominant species, right? The whole Adam and Eve thing is bullshit. God did not make the non-reproducing species first, and the rest is just patriarchal conspiracy. That's what I've learned from my daughters. I mean, they haven't said that to me. I've said that to them, but they've learned by observation. I look forward to that docuseries, Burns laughed. As a local journalist, she writes, especially recently, I'm spending a lot of time trying to identify and preserve stories that they feel they are being overlooked. I know that's something you've done in this series. I've tried in all the series to do a bottom-up as well as top-down perspective. I don't want that unforgiving revisionism to throw out the top-down version, which often happens with revisionism, saying it's only this, the other stuff doesn't matter, everything matters. The problem is, for too long, it's just been a top-down story in American history. The sequence of presidential administrations punctuated by wars. It's much more interesting and more complicated than that. I spent my entire professional life making films that are broadcast on PBS. I'm independent. I don't work for any particular station, but all of them go there because they're invested locally. It's the largest television network in the country. It has 330 stations. They are the ones that keep local news alive and local stories alive. It's very much bottom up. So there's something that I recognize. I feel kind of connection to that way of doing it. I live in rural New Hampshire. I moved out of New York City. I assumed that in becoming a documentary filmmaker, strike one, on PBS, strike two, in American history, strike three, that I had just taken a vow of anonymity and poverty. I'm very happy to tell you that neither has happened, but I still live in the same house I moved to, sleeping in the same bedroom that I moved to in this tiny village in New Hampshire, where I could live for nothing because I was willing to give up the stuff in order to be able to tell those kinds of local stories. As news becomes so homogenized and corporatized, sometimes the PBS station is the only news there is. Somebody's got to cover the school board. Somebody's got to be covering the zoning board. Somebody's got to be covering. There's something fishy about the relationship between this person and that development that's going on out of town. Or just the lives of ordinary people who are caught up in the indifference, the icy indifference of incipient authoritarianism. As you were doing research for this project and for others, did you have a sense that these overlooked stories were being disseminated and shared among people at the time, but then filtered out over history by the people writing? And he interrupts, I don't think there's a conspiracy. I know what you mean. These stories are told. It's just that the ease and simplification for teaching has mainly been the reductionist one. I mean, we don't mention Betsy Ross in our film. We say we don't know who made the first flag. That's what we say because we don't know who made the first one. So I think that's not so much a conspiracy, but it's just consider who's telling it and what's going on. These stories have been around. People have been reading them. Scholars have been including them. It's our job, when we decide to do something like this, to spend the nearly 10 years to deep dive into the scholarship, to go back to the primary sources, to find more stuff, and then share them without a concern. Betsy Ambler's in the series. She's 10 years old when the war begins and 16 when it ends. Her family's from Yorktown, and that's an important place, but they're refugees. And their circumstances, they're pretty well-to-do, and their circumstances are greatly diminished. There's a 14-year-old kid from Boston who joins the militia, the Patriot Militia, and there's a 15-year-old kid who joins the Continental Army. These are great stories to tell, and there are women all up and down this story, and there are Native Americans, there are free blacks and enslaved black people who have a particularly intensive stake in the outcomes. I have a neon sign in my editing room in cursive. It's been there for years and years, and it says, "It's complicated." That's it. It's there to remind me and everyone else that it's super complicated, this whole business. There is not a filmmaker or a journalist who, when you have a beautiful sentence or a scene that works, you don't want to touch it. But your dictum in your business is to kill the little darlings. The sentences you're most proud of in ours is to have the courage to open up those scenes and say, I've learned contradictory information. It may destabilize what works about the scene, but it ultimately serves the purpose of a much more complicated and accurate thing. But it is super complicated. I was saying during the PBS interview today that Wynton Marsalis said to us in our film on jazz, sometimes a thing and the opposite of a thing are true at the same time. I think it's incumbent upon us, particularly now, when we live in a computer age where everything's a one or a zero, a political world in which something is either right or wrong, red state or blue state, to be able to tolerate the contradictions that exist and that we know in our own friends and our own spouses and our own children, and to be able to say, why can't I have my history in the same way? Benedict Arnold is introduced in the first seconds of episode 2, and it isn't until about 40% of the way through episode 6 you find out that he's Benedict Arnold. Up to that point, he's Benedict Arnold, one of our frightenest generals, and he's a hero at Quebec, an even greater hero at Saratoga, and Washington loves him. Then you find out what happens. And that's possible too, even in the case of George Washington, understand he's a deeply flawed human being, as we all are, who's rash, who makes a lot of mistakes, and without whom we would not have a country, period, full stop. We're not supposed to say that. He's not supposed to be a great man, capital G, capital M, having that kind of primacy in the story anymore. But I have two black historians in a row saying, without him, there's no United States. Do you have a favorite president, Abraham Lincoln? As you were going through primary sources, what did you learn or notice about how people preserved history around them as it was happening? It's pretty amazing. The young girl, Betsy Ambler from Yorktown, actually wrote a memoir in the early 19th century about those revolution days to her younger sister, who was born after July 4th. Her father called the younger sister his only independent daughter. She was too young to remember, so Betsy wrote this beautiful memoir in which they go back to Yorktown. Before the final drama takes place, they're in reduced circumstances, so they're in a tiny shack on the outskirts of town, not their big former mansion in town. And she says at one point, quote, we were playing by the most novelous river, and we would also almost fancy ourselves heroines. It's so beautiful. What you realize is the great gift of how articulate and literate people were. We believe, historians believe, that American colonies were, well, only Scandinavians were more literate than us. That literacy provides us with a record, whether it's a diary or a memoir after the fact, or a correspondence, say, between Abigail and John Adams, which is just amazing, or some of the official business of the people considering the ideas at the Constitutional Convention. We benefit so much from the extraordinary use of language. Right now we're down to, like, are you okay? Instead of just go back and read the first sentence of the Declaration. It's basically saying, we kind of owe you an explanation for what we're about to do. It's a beautiful sentence. The second sentence is the most important sentence besides I love you in the English language. We hold these truths to be self-evident. But go back and read the other one, because it's just so gorgeously written. It's almost like a piece of music. And the use of language then becomes one of our great secret weapons. We are a visual medium, but in the beginning is the word. Our script, in this case written by Jeff Ward, but it's tightened and polished by all of us, especially me, in the editing room. It's really tight, and it's economical. As long as 12 hours may seem, it is economical. We have just been exposed to great writing, telling the history of an America, and we hope that our own work is equal to at least representing it. All right, I very much appreciate the opportunity to read these more thinkable pieces, more or less. But enough about me. Let's talk about Georgianne Eubanks, Sarah Edwards writes. She invites you to look a little closer. Sarah Edwards wrote this on May 25th. Georgianne Eubanks is all lit up and talking about fireflies. The writer says, there are 75 species in the eastern part of the country. We're still discovering more. But we're discovering them even as we are destroying them. Of these 75, she's describing a specific one native to pockets of southern Appalachia, the blue ghost firefly. Unlike the bright blink we associate with most backyard lightning bugs, the species many of us are guilty of having trapped in tinfoil-topped mason jars as children and probably killed, this firefly is distinct for hovering en masse about a foot off the ground while emitting a blue-white light, prolonged and almost sapphire at its deepest, like fairies, Eubanks says. She's seen the blue ghosts on a private nighttime tour, as she details in her new book, only to later spot them outside her mountain cabin, at which point she excitedly reported the sighting to her guide from the tour. She recalls the guide saying with a laugh, I've been doing this for 10 years. You don't know how many people who've lived here 30 years, their whole life, whatever, and never saw the fireflies until they went on my tour and discovered they had them too. Such grounding moments drive the fabulous ordinary, discovering the natural wonders of the wild South. That's Eubanks' new book, out just last month from the UNC Press. Donna Campbell, Eubanks' longtime collaborator, contributed the photographs. When I reached out to Eubanks for an interview, I asked in my email if there was a spot we could meet that was perhaps reflective of her book's subject. I don't know what I expected, maybe the Hall River, maybe the North Carolina Botanical Garden, but she responded and asked to meet at a gazebo where the frogs sing after a rain. The gazebo in question turned out to be steps from her Carborough condominium. As we spoke, she held up her hands every so often to listen for a frog, their intermittent sonic appearances underscoring the ordinary, which is referenced in her title. Across 15 chapters, The Fabulous Ordinary explores annual miracles that take place in 7 states. For North Carolinians, some are more immediately accessible, like the fireflies or bugling elk in Cherokee and moths in Little Switzerland. An astonishing fact I learned from Eubanks, in contrast to the state's 175 butterfly species, North Carolina has upward of 3,000 moth species. Other miracles require a longer drive, but one you'll likely feel compelled to make, as Eubanks sketches out how a variety of factors, relatively stable climate, slower development, have made the Southeast a dramatic hot spot of biodiversity. The climate emergency is endemic to any conversation about the natural world. The week Eubanks and I met, President Trump had just cleared 100 days in office, a stretch marked by, among other transgressions, the mass firing of thousands of EPA and National Park Service workers, and 145 actions rolling back the clean air and water protections. In this book, The Fabulous Ordinary, climate urgency is transmitted through wonder and a sturdy sense of place. There are things you should see before they're gone, she says, and you should take your kids and grandkids to see. She grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. Her paternal grandparents were both savvy about plants. At her grandmother's funeral, when people cast flowers on the grave, Eubanks recalls her aunt saying she could tell you the Latin name of every one of those flowers. Eubanks spent the first 2 decades of her career working as a consultant in higher education, with fiction as her main creative outlet. Eventually, she says, the gene kicked in, and she began taking on creative non-fiction projects that intersected with the natural world. She says of her love for nonfiction, There are already too many great stories out there. Why would I want to make one up? In 2007, UNC Press published her book on the literary trails of North Carolina, a project she persuaded her editors to turn into three books. That series then spawned 2018's The Month of Their Ripening, North Carolina Heritage Foods Through the Year, an exploration of Tar Heels foods at peak readiness in the calendar, and in 2021, Saving the Wild South, which had Eubanks tromping around six states to visit botanical species wavering on the edge of extinction. The Fabulous Ordinary serves as a bit of sequel to the latter, broadening the lens from endangered plants to phenomena. Books from academic presses, often specialized, don't always reach the average consumer. And while the Fabulous Ordinary could seem fusty on description, fabulous strikes me as a word perhaps more often associated with the clothing boutique, Eubanks' lyrical gifts shine through clearly. As her editor at UNC Press, Lucas Church, writes, this new book is not a guidebook in the traditional sense. He wrote in an email to Indy, her gift as a writer is that she immediately entrances the reader, offering a beautiful mix of evocative descriptions of, say, the sounds made by the sandhill crane, or why the eastern spadefoot toad has elliptical pupils, while firmly grounding her storytelling in the relationship between us and nature and how we must be better stewards of our environment. A chapter on dimpled trout lilies is almost thriller-like in its description of how a plot of the lilies, 30 acres large, came to be discovered near Wiggum, Georgia, just shy of the Florida Panhandle and far from the plant's native habitat, when a highway expanded several decades ago. Later in the early 2000s, a small group of citizens banded together to conserve the property's rare tens of millions of flowers, distinct for their daily ritual of opening from dawn to dusk. If you pay a morning visit at just the right time, you may bear witness to a mass yellow unfurling. Interestingly, several of the places chronicled, like this plot of lilies and a remote Alabama canyon full of glowing larvae, are not federally owned, reflecting a lack of state and federal investment in the Southeast ecology. But if private ownership is not an ideal model for conservation, Eubanks nevertheless finds hope in citizen efforts, arguing that drawing people's attention to the singular aspects of where we live can help create sturdier regional identities. If the political is personal, so are the plants. There's the sight of 500,000 purple martins in flight in Lexington, South Carolina, which Eubanks compares to the spectacle of 18th century migrations of the passenger pigeon, quoting an 1813 passage in which James Audubon described witnessing over 3 days what he estimated to be billions of birds like an eclipse. Passenger pigeons are now extinct, thanks to the hunting crazes of centuries past. But historical asides like that offer helpful comparison points, not just for what we have, but what we've already missed out on. Upon witnessing those purple martins, Eubanks writes, there are as many of their dark bodies as there are openings of light, a loose shawl across the sky. Her previous book, Saving the Wild South, may have had a direct rallying cry as its title, but its follow-up also offers generously portraits of wonder, a kind of rendering that may animate and move people to act. As she writes, the task for readers now is to, quote, locate a contiguous kind of appreciation that can be kindled and do something to repair the world. That change begins with an invitation to form a relationship with plants and places we are at most at danger of losing. Also the frogs. She says, we're in a lot of trouble. We've got a lot of smart people working on the problem, but we need more people who care. I probably have time for this last fairly long article, again by Lena Geller. A 1960s-era Raleigh shopping center revitalizes and future-proofs. I'm reading this partly because I used to live near there. Cacao beans have more than tripled in price since 2020. Commercial equipment costs are surging under new tariffs, and when Ecosu's lease came up for renewal last December, the Raleigh chocolate shop's landlord proposed a 30% rent hike. But rising expenses aren't the only challenge facing owner Tiana Young and Danielle Centeno, who opened Escazú in 2008. Since the pandemic, they've noticed a fundamental shift in how customers shop. Young says, being tucked away on somewhere used to be a plus, but now it feels like a con. Ecosu has stood on Blunt Street for 15 years, operating from a quiet storefront with ample parking. People are not just coming to a one-off store. They want to go somewhere where they can do all the things. What's being built and what people are attracted to, Young has observed, are clusters of things. From Kerry's gleaming mixed-use Fenton development to the industrial chic Raleigh Ironworks to Person Street Plaza's walkable hub of shops and cafes. For all those reasons, plus wanting a space where customers can see the chocolate-making process through glass windows, Escazú is relocating to Raleigh's Gateway Plaza in June. The 1960s-era shopping center sits behind a Greyhound bus station off of Capitol Boulevard. They're not the only businesses making that move. Fiction Kitchen, the vegan restaurant that stood on Dawson Street, downtown Raleigh, for over a decade, cuts the ribbon on its new permanent location on May 14th in Gateway Plaza. Also opening then is the Malapata, a Latin American restaurant with an adjacent mezcal bar called Peyote. And there's an unannounced restaurant concept that is expected to take over the former fine folk space in the coming months, reportedly from well-established operators in Raleigh. When that concept moves in, it will be the first time since the plaza's 2018 revitalization that every unit will be filled. So what's behind this clustering trend? Has the pandemic permanently changed how and where people spend money? Centeno theorizes that it's in part reflective of Raleigh's changing demographics. Since 2020, the Raleigh metro area has expanded at nearly four times the national rate, growing by 10% to reach 1.5 million people by 2024. Centeno says, when we all reemerged from our houses, these new people became part of the mix, and it changed the customer dynamic. The influence of newcomers, combined with shifting consumer habits, has created both challenge and opportunity. But relocating to a busier commercial district is not merely about visibility. For Centeno and other Gateway Plaza newcomers, there's a deeper calculus at work. After weathering pandemic shutdowns and supply chain chaos, these business owners are looking for security in numbers. They're looking to build resilience in a world where another crisis feels just around the corner. Gateway was originally anchored by a Winn-Dixie grocery store. It changed hands several times over the decades and underwent the typical decay of a mid-century strip mall before being revitalized in the 2010s and acquired by its current owner, Loden Properties. The shopping center has a less fussy feel than other developments that have sprung up around Wake County. Centeno says she and Young like that the plaza isn't, quote, as bright rigid as some other places where they want it to look homogenous. Angela Salamanca, the longtime Raleigh restaurateur who's opening Malapata with partners Marshall Davis, with whom she runs Gallo Pelon, Ex Voto and Patty Boy, and Eric Montagne and Zach Gregg, who have previously worked together at places like Local Seafood and Standard Beer and Food, says Gateway, quote, looks different than a lot of the other places that have popped up around downtown that are maybe a little more manicured. Carolyn Morrison, owner of Fiction Kitchen, who grew up in Durham and attended Meredith College in Raleigh, says the plaza used to be one of her favorite thrift store areas. The plaza currently houses the bars Mordecai Beverage and Natural Science Bar, the casual Japanese eatery Miso Ramen, Union Special, a bakery with a large wholesale component, and a music store, a game shop, a hair salon, hot yoga studio, and a large co-working space, almost all of which are locally owned. The mix creates a natural ecosystem where customers can spend a full day. There are shared outdoor seating areas and a stage in the parking lot, but some of the most innovative community building is happening indoors amongst the businesses themselves. At the east end of the plaza, Malapata and Fiction Kitchen are pioneering a space-sharing arrangement. They share restrooms, a dishwashing station, and, despite the fact that Fiction is fully vegan, while Malapata specializes in carnitas tacos and fish cooked in chili broth, a large walk-in cooler. They've established clear boundaries to make it work. Fiction has the front part of the walk-in, eliminating the need to navigate through the meat products. Fiction's kitchen floor is painted bright green and Malapata's burnt orange, with a clear border where the two meet. There's no one cutting through our kitchen with a tray of chicken, Morrison clarifies. The arrangement emerged from the food hall experiences of Malapartner's partners, who between the four of them operate Ex Voto, Patty Boy, and Locals Seafood in Durham. Locals also previously had a stall at Transfer Company Food Hall in Raleigh, at Durham Hall, where Indy reported on extensive operational and management issues. There were some things that weren't really thought through with so many people working in shared spaces, Salamanca says. The lessons from those experiences informed how Malapata approached its current collaboration. The arrangement affords efficiencies that not only lower day-to-day costs like dishwasher labor, but provide built-in flexibility in case of emergency. Malapata's menu is centered around masa and agave, and its owners put a lot of thought into representing that in the main dining room. There are custom corn husk lamps from Colombia and a massive branch salvaged from 30-year-old agave plant, but they also designed with contingency plans in mind. If disaster strikes, Peyote, the tiny 7-seat mezcal bar tucked into a breezeway beside the restaurant, can function as a compact headquarters for takeout service. Salamanca saying, it's our solution if we ever have another pandemic. It's a smaller footprint. We can push as much food as we can, and it can be done by very little staff. Fiction Kitchen's move was similarly strategic. Morrison says the space we were in had a couple of restrictions for trying to make a pandemic work. No outdoor seating. Takeout was difficult because of street logistics. That pandemic transformed their business model overnight. We went from never doing takeout to now takeout is still 30% of our business. There's no way for us to say, okay, we're not doing takeout anymore. The specter of COVID looms large. Even the name Malapata, which translates roughly to bad luck, acknowledges how the partners came together through adversity. The story behind Peyote is more fun. During a brainstorming session to come up with a name for the bar, someone suggested the Taking the hallucinogenic cactus might help with creative inspiration. And the name stuck. We just talked about it. We didn't do it, Salamanca insists. At the other end of Gateway Plaza, Union Special keeps emergency supplies at the ready. The bakery had barely finished its first 6 months in business when the world shut down. During those early days, their owner, Andrew Ulam, created a makeshift takeout window for selling baked goods and loaves of bread. And he says of that takeout window, "I still have it. I'll never get rid of it. It's across the street in the storage unit. If something hits tomorrow, I still have a takeout window." Ulam was previously a co-owner of the comfort food restaurant Fine Folk, which occupied the space next to Union Special before it closed in 23. He also had a downtown expansion of Union Special that closed the next year. And he says, "There's some trauma that we all carry. If this goes down the tubes, what can we do? If business slowed down, how do we get people to actually come here?" Ulam's approach to future-proofing Union Special involves expanding the bakery's wholesale operations. He's securing a new production facility, partnering with a major food distributor to get his bread into markets throughout the Southeast, and placing markets at RDU Airport. Escazú's move to Gateway comes with a significant menu expansion. They'll begin offering scooped ice cream, a product they've made for years but only sold in pints. The owners don't use the exact term pandemic proofing, but acknowledge they're diversifying their business to be more resilient. Young says the idea of having two different seasonal products makes the business stronger. Chocolate sells best in the winter, ice cream in the summer, and ice cream is not as cacao dependent, so we'll have two different main ingredients as opposed to one. Young and Continuo have also designated part of the new Escazú space for packaging and shipping. At any point, they have to go back to contactless service. "At this point, it's very clear there's absolutely no normal," says Young. "Everything is different. We need to put ourselves in a position to weather what's going on currently and hopefully be stronger." Well, John Feddersen for Indie Week has to close up shop here at Broadcast Station. This program will air as a podcast after Friday, on Friday afternoon. Then it and all the other podcasts are still available at ncreadingservice.org. So for that NC Reading Service, I bid you all a good day, and we'll be with you next week with another issue from The Independent, The Indie Week. Bye-bye.